To talk a little bit, we're approaching the month of Adar, and this Shabbos we have a special. It's not one of the Tariag Mitzvahs per se, but we have a special series of four Torah readings that are miyuchad, that are special for this time of year, starting from Rosh Chodesh Adar, going through Rosh Chodesh Nisan, and these are called the four Parshios, and which means there's the regular Torah reading of the week, and then we have a special maftir and a haftorah. And this week is the first of the four, and it's called Parsha Shkalim, which talks about the mitzvah of giving the half shekel. There was a mitzvah that every year Jews were expected to give the equivalent of a half shekel. It's not the same as the half shekel of a modern coin. The half shekel for the upkeep of the Beis HaMikdash and the Korbanos, and this was a chiyuv. Actually, in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, this actually is a mitzvah d'oraisa to give a half shekel. And the half shekel had to be given for the fiscal year, every year, but the year in the Beis HaMikdash began in Nisan. And from Nisan to the end of Adar, all Korbanos have to be brought from newly collected money. Even if there was a surplus in the Beis HaMikdash's treasury from the year before, that would not suffice. That had to be used for other things, but the Korbanos, the Tamid, the daily offering, had to be brought from new money. So that means as soon as Nisan began, they had to have some new money in the treasury. Otherwise, they couldn't bring Korbanos. So Chazal say they began announcing the collection of new money 1 month before Nisan, which was Rosh Chodesh Adar. So to commemorate the mitzvah of Machtzis HaShekel that began on Rosh Chodesh Adar, we read about the mitzvah of giving the half shekel. So that's called Parsha Shkalim. Now, the Gemara says in Maseches Megillah the following. If you remember, when Haman was negotiating with the king, Ahasuerus, in order to get permission to kill the entire Jewish people. So the Gemara tells us that, the Megillah Esther tells us, he weighed out to Ahasuerus 10,000 talents of silver. That's a huge amount of money. A kikor is a huge, one talent is a huge amount of silver, something like the equivalent in modern money of something like at least $10,000. And this is 10,000 times 10,000, kikor kesef. So the Gemara says in Megillah, Hashem knew that Haman would try to destroy us by giving shkalim to Ahasuerus. Therefore, Hashem wanted us to give our shkalim first, so that our shkalim will countermand the effect of Haman's shkalim. And therefore, that is why we start giving our shkalim 2 weeks before Purim, Rosh Chodesh Adar. This is a statement of Reish Lakish, since Hashem knew when he gave us the mitzvah that Haman would try to destroy us by giving Ahasuerus shkalim. He gave us a mitzvah to give shkalim, so our shkalim can overcome the effect of his shkalim. Now that's a very, very strange statement in the Gemara, because first of all, Haman's shkalim were not given to God. Haman's shkalim were given to Ahasuerus. They were just a bribe. And in what sense do our shkalim overcome his shkalim? What power would his shkalim have, so to speak, that our shkalim have to overcome them? And b'chlal, what is the connection of his shkalim to our shkalim? Right? His was a bribe to Ahasuerus, ours is a korban to Hashem. So the Sifri Chassidus, the Sfas Emes, other Svarim, they give a very beautiful explanation for this. And they say the following. It's a well-known phenomenon that Megillas Esther, the name of Hashem, is not mentioned. It's actually it may be the only book in Tanakh in which the name of Hashem is not mentioned. The reason why I say it may be the only book is because possibly there's one other book, depending on how you define a word, and that is paradoxically Shir HaShirim. Shir HaShirim, which is a love song between God and the Jewish people, by using the parable of a king and a princess, or a shepherd and a princess. Shir HaShirim also does not mention the name of God, except for one possible word at the end of the book, when it talks about how powerful love is. It calls it Shalhevesya. Now, Shalheves means a burning torch. But it depends if Shalhevesya is one word or two words. If it's one word, it's just a term for a burning torch. But if you read it, shall heves ka, it would mean a burning torch ignited by God. So Shir HaShirim, there is at least a shaila if the name of Hashem is mentioned. It's so strange, because you would think a whole song about the love of Hashem for the Jewish people should specifically mention God's name, but as they say, that's a question. But Megillas Esther, it's for sure, it does not mention Shem Hashem. Now, as a little aside, we actually have, I think I may have mentioned this in an earlier share, we actually have an alternative version of Megillas Esther in the Apocrypha. Remember, the Apocrypha are the books of that were not canonized in the Tanakh, like the Book of the Maccabees. So some of the books are totally separate, like the Book of the Maccabees. But some of the things in the Apocrypha are alternative versions or additions to existing biblical books that the sages decided did not deserve canonical treatment. And one of those is the Book of Esther. There's an alternative Book of Esther, which is 90% the same as our book. But there is one major addition in that Book of Esther, and that is a lengthy prayer that Esther prayed to God before she entered Ahasuerus. So paradoxically, you could have thought that the Greek version is more from. The Greek version is the more religious one. The Greek version in the Apocrypha is the one that mentions Shem Hashem. And yet Chazal established that is not authentic. It was an attempt to put in the Shem Hashem by some later person, but that was not the original version of the book. So on one hand, we know that the Book of Esther does not mention the name of God, and there's all deep reasons for that. A part of it is because Purim represents the idea of hiddenness, because unlike the splitting of the Red Sea, where God's presence is open and obvious and everybody can see it, the whole Book of Esther, God is operating behind the scenes in very subtle ways, right? Ahasuerus kills Vashti. Well, ancient people, kings did that. He picks Esther, you got to pick somebody. Mordechai happens to overhear an assassination plot, right? Everything could be chalked up to a series of coincidences, but ultimately Hashem is controlling it. But since it is concealment, that is merumas in Hashem's name not being mentioned. Yet.
Is there anything in our Book of Esther that's not in the Apocrypha?
I believe not. I can check it. I have that version too, but I believe the Apocrypha is only an addition. It didn't take anything out. Yeah.
I learned that Hashem is not mentioned by name, but he's
present.
Yeah. Right. Well, that's what I'm going to mention now.
Derek 6,
Right. So, 100% correct that although Hashem is not mentioned explicitly by name, but there are many hidden allusions, right? Hashem's hiddenness is manifest throughout the Megillas Esther. One of them is when Esther invites, these are Ramazim, these are hints. When Esther invites Haman to the party, which will be his downfall, she says, Yavo Hamelech v'Haman Hayom. May the king and Haman come today to the party. The first letters of that is Yud Kei Vav Kei, the shame, the tetragrammon, the four-letter name of God. In fact, I'll always remember this because I remember one time I was in yeshiva many, many years ago. And sometimes when a person's reading Megillah and people make noise for the Haman, people don't hear a word, whatever it is. So apparently the Baal Kore, I don't know how this was noticed, but somebody pointed out the Baal Kore skipped the word Hayom. He says, Yavo HaMelech VaHaman, and everybody made noise. And the Baal Kore skipped the word Hayom and just continued onwards. And somebody had a recording and they listened. And I remember we were woken up in the middle of the night.
So you wouldn't accidentally...
So we have to hear Megillah again. In other words, we didn't...
Well, did he skip so he wouldn't act so as to not say the name in vain? Or
No. He skipped it because in the noise, skipped it. Now, maybe he said it and nobody heard it. I don't know, which would have been the same thing. So we actually, middle of the night, we get to hear Megillah again.
Everybody got up to say the Megillah?
I don't know. I don't even remember what happened. But I remember this idea. But the Hasidic guys who were more attuned to Kabbalistic Ramazim were especially attuned to the idea that he didn't just skip a word. Any word would have been, bad. But he skipped the last letter of the Shem HaKadosh Baruch Hu that's in the Megillah. And that's a very serious thing. You're called Pogem B'Shem. You made a dent in the name of Hashem. And that's kind of a... I think the Hasidim were using it as an argument against the non-Hasidic. You know, that's what a non-Hasidic, you know, person, he doesn't have the shlemus, the perfection of God's name. But the Zohar gives another aspect of God too that's very important. This is maybe what you heard as well. And that is, often the Megillah talks about the Melech. And even though Melech means Achashverosh, according to literal meaning, but there's always a secondary meaning that it's referring to Melech Malchei Amlachim. So for example, when it says that night the king couldn't sleep, and therefore, right, it's also referring to the idea that it says in Tehillim, Hinei lo yanum lo yishan shomer Yisrael, that the guardian of Israel does not slumber or sleep, meaning God didn't sleep that night. God, you know, Gavyacha, God is looking after his people. Which means to say, in any verse where the word Hamelech appears, there's a double meaning. There is the literal meaning of King Achashverosh, and you have to interpret it that way, King Achashverosh, because certainly this does not replace the simple meaning of the verse, but there's a higher meaning that is a reference to God. So now, let's look at it this way. When Haman goes to Achashverosh, therefore, so the Pasuk says, Haman will say things to the king. That has to be understood on a lower level, and on a higher level. No. The lower level is human being, bad guy Haman, says to human being, idiot king. Right? That's one level. Higher level, the koach of evil that Haman represents, the power of Amalek, is prosecuting the Jewish people to God. Right? Lower level, higher level. So, let's look at a certain speech that Haman makes and see how you can understand at least some of that speech on a lower level and on a higher level. And we're gonna move back to how this connects to the half shekel shortly. Yeah, if you have your art scroll Chumash here.
1252?
Well, that's the beginning of it. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it starts on 1252. Yeah, verse 8. It's on 1255. 1255. Chapter 3, verse 8. Right? Haman is trying to make the case to Achashverosh that the Jews deserve to be... Although, remember, he doesn't mention the Jews, by the way. He doesn't even tell Achashverosh what nation he's talking about. And the Gemara even says that this is a sign that Achashverosh was not too bright here, because he's giving Haman a blank check without even knowing who he's talking about. But it says, Haman said to the king Achashverosh, right, verse 8, Pasuk Ches, there is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your realm. Their laws are different from every other people. They do not observe even the king's laws. Therefore, it is not befitting the king to tolerate them. If it pleases the king, let it be recorded that they be destroyed, and I will pay. So Haman is paying for this privilege. I will pay 10,000 silver talents into the hands of those who perform the duties for deposit in the king's treasure. And Achashverosh actually says, the silver is given to you. Achashverosh says, I don't even have to take the money. You take it. You can do it for free. But Achashverosh is very magnanimous. He says, you want to kill this nation? He says, you don't even have to pay me for it. Now, if you look at the
Hebrew...
Yeah, it's quite generous. Quite generous of him, that's right. Now, if you look at the Hebrew, because really you have to get, they want to show you something in Hebrew. Haman says to King Achashverosh, there is one nation, Mephozar u'Mephorad, scattered and dispersed. Let's try to understand that phraseology, both on a lower level and at a higher level. On a lower level, it's Haman, human Haman, to King Achashverosh. So on that lower level, he's simply making the point that because the Jews are dispersed, they're not a single unity in one place, it would be easy to exterminate them simply because they're not able to organize themselves in a cohesive manner. So on that simple, literal level, Mephozar u'Mephorad is simply referring to their vulnerability and their weakness, and therefore it wouldn't be a big deal to get rid of them. But if you accept the idea of the Zohar that every reference to Melech is also a reference to God, and therefore by extension, by analogy, the references to Haman are a reference to the powers of evil that are prosecuting the Jewish people in God's eyes, then this has to be read not just as an argument of convenience, this has to be read as a spiritual indictment. The Koach of Amalek, of which Haman is descended, is telling God the Jewish people deserve to be destroyed, not because they're physically scattered, but it's a reference to the fact that there is hatred, there is polarization, there is disunity. In other words, the Achilles heel of this people is the what's called the sinas chinam, the hatred and polarization. And that is what gives Amalek spiritual power over us, because when there is disunity and hatred and fragmentation within us, Amalek has the power to vanquish us on the outside. So in effect, what this represents is the kitrug. Kitrug means the prosecution, the accusation in Shemayim, was that the Jewish people deserve to be destroyed because of the hatred and disunity that exists within them. That is why, by the way, when Mordechai gets the news of Haman's decree, and Mordechai wears sackcloth and ashes, and he communicates to Esther the queen that there's this awful gezeira. So look at what Esther says. Esther says initially, look at 1256, verse 16. Esther said to reply to Mordechai, "Go assemble all the Jews to be found in Shushan and fast for me." Right? Do not eat or drink 3 days. But it's important. She didn't just say fast. She emphasized lech in Hebrew. It's even more explicit. Lech kenos. If the reason we're vulnerable is because we are mefuzer or meforid, we are scattered and separated, the only way we can overcome that is lech kenos, by becoming unified and together. Okay? In other words, basically, from a heavenly standpoint, the power of Haman over Am Yisrael came from a lack of achdus within Am Yisrael. And in effect, in a spiritual way, allegorically, this is the currency by which Haman paid for the privilege. In other words, again, literally, Haman is paying with silver. Spiritually, the shkolim, the thing that buys God's acquiescence, right? God's acquiescence is purchased with the currency, so to speak, of sinas chinam, of the needless hatred. So now we can understand the Gemara that I began with. I began with the statement of the Gemara that says, God knew that Haman would give shkolim to Achashverosh to destroy the Jews, and therefore God gave us a mitzvah of shkolim first. If you understand allegorically, the shkolim of Haman represents the currency of sinas chinam, which was Haman's, the Haman and Shemayim, so to speak, Haman's argument to God that the Jews were deserving of destruction. You can then understand how the mitzvah of machzis hashekel counteracts that. Because when you look at the mitzvah of machzis hashekel, you see two interesting phenomena. First of all, the Torah emphasizes, with the idea of machzis hashekel, that everybody has to be the same. The rich man does not give more. Even if you're rich, you don't give more. And the poor man is not allowed to give less. Machzis hashekel, everybody has to give the same amount. Now, we understand why the poor guy can't give less. You know, everyone has to give something. But why would there be a rule that the rich guy can't give more? I mean, after all, I mean, I'm not aware of any yeshiva or any shul that would ever say, you're not allowed to give us more money. You know, we would take more money. Yeah.
They don't want to
embarrass people. Right, so part of it is they want to embarrass, and part of it is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was saying, every single Jew has an equality of access to God. We don't make the temple, the Beis HaMikdash, you know, the repository of those who could afford it, so to speak. Every Jew stands before God as equal. Now, when I say equality, I don't necessarily mean everybody's on the same level. Obviously, there are righteous people and people who are not righteous, but it means that every Jew has the capacity to have that equal relationship before God. Now, this is true not only in money, which is obvious. This is even true in spiritual attainments. That, you know, every person is judged not by what they do objectively. I mean, let's say one person could learn 1,000 pages of Gemara a day, and another person only learned one page. But if each person is doing their best, each person is working at their highest capacity, in God's eyes, they stand with equality before their Creator. And in fact, to turn it around in an opposite way, let's say the guy who could learn 1,000 pages a day only learns 500, right? And he goes to the movies in the afternoon. And somebody else works hard to learn one page over a whole day or a whole week. In God's book, the one-page guy is higher. Because the one page is giving Hashem 100%. And the one that's doing 500 pages a day is only giving Hashem 50%. Hashem does not judge any of us, by our objective accomplishments. Hashem judges us by how much effort we're putting forth. So the thing that you hear in school, which is never true, that the only thing you count is your effort. Now the truth in school, that's actually not true, right? You'll fail or you'll pass based on what you produce. But in the heavenly book, it's all based on effort. And Hashem just looks at everyone's situation. And if you're doing the best you can, you're giving Hashem your... I know none of us give 100%, but you're giving Hashem, you know, as much as you can do, then you stand with equality to the greatest tzaddik. So the thing is that if every person understands that they stand with equality of dignity in the presence of Hashem, then there's not going to be sinas chinam. So much sinas chinam is jealousy. I'm jealous because somebody can accomplish this. They have more money than me. They're more powerful than me. They're more handsome than me. They're smarter than me. Whatever it is. And as a result, in order for me to kind of not feel below him, I kind of have to lower him to my level. Like there, you know, you can try to raise yourself, but that's harder. It's easier when you want to create an equilibrium. It's much easier to pull the other guy down. But if you realize your own chashivas, if you realize your own importance, if you realize that you stand before Hashem with an equal dignity and an equal access, then there's no reason to belittle anyone else. In other words, I shouldn't belittle the people who are, so to speak, below me, because they too have an equality of access. And I shouldn't be jealous of those who are above me, because I too will be judged as favorably as them if I do my part. So the sinas chinam can either be a disparagement of your inferiors or a jealousy of your superiors. But the machzis hashekel counteracts either of those types of stigmas, because it reassures you that those who accomplished more are not necessarily going to be better than you if you do whatever you can to serve Hashem. And it also humbles you in not thinking you're better than somebody below you, because they too have that same equality of access. So now you understand, in a sense, the mitzvah of Machzis HaShekel that focuses on the equality of access before God and the dignity of every person before Hashem is an antidote that counteracts the shkolim of Haman, which were based on Mefuzar, Mefurad, Sinas Chinam, polarization, delegitimation, demonization, etc. Now, there's another aspect of half shekel that's interesting too, and that is, you'll notice that the half shekel is given as a half shekel. As opposed to saying everybody should give a shekel, we say everybody gives a half shekel. Now, point out, a half shekel does not mean a coin that's divided in half. There actually was a coin, just like in modern Israeli currency, although the half shekel of the Mikdash was worth much more. But there's a coin called a half shekel. But why does HaKadosh Baruch Hu say give a half shekel? Why doesn't HaKadosh Baruch Hu say give a shekel? Well, you might say, you know, God doesn't want to overly tax us. But in the Sifri Chassidus, they say a beautiful thought. That is, a half shekel represents an idea that by yourself you are incomplete unless you combine it with another. Right? A half is an incomplete entity unless you combine it with another half to make a whole. And therefore, if the first lesson of the half shekel is equality of dignity, the second lesson of the half shekel is interdependence. In other words, how each of us need each other to be able to serve God. And that too is an antidote that combats sinas chinam. Because if you recognize how much you need each person, and also how much each person needs you, then you understand that to serve Hashem, to create an Am Yisrael, people have to work together, they have to look at the different views of other people, they have to take them into account. So that is what the Gemara means when the Gemara says that Hashem knew Haman would have his shkalim, and his shkalim, based on the higher meaning, is Mefuzar Mefurad Bein HaAmim. Therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us our shkalim to counteract his shkalim, and our shkalim, both in terms of equality and in terms of the fractions, the fact that it's not a whole, teaches me equality of dignity and the lesson of interdependence. And that, in turn, is a refuah, is a spiritual healing that that combats the tendency of sinas chinam, which gives Amalek this power over us. Now, this is why, since Purim does celebrate the downfall of Amalek, right? Because Haman comes from Amalek, Purim celebrates the downfall of Amalek. That's even why we make noise and we stomp when Haman's name is said, because the Torah says you're supposed to eradicate Amalek, and this is like a physical way. In fact, they even have a thing, some people...
I think, Haman's name on the bottom of the
Mishnah. Sure, right, yeah, yeah.
In fact, stepping on it.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, all the time or just on Purim?
No, there's no harm.
Oh, okay. You do it all the time.
You fulfill a Amalek.
Yeah.
Eventually, it'll fall off.
Yeah. By the way, just a little bit of a culinary comment. You know, we have the thing that we call Hamantaschen. Hamantaschen means Haman's pockets or Haman's hats, etc. And it's not really clear. You know, why do you call it Hamantaschen? So I did read that this was actually a mistranslation. Mun in Yiddish or German actually means poppy seeds. So the original name was Muntaschen. Muntaschen means pockets filled with poppy seed, because that was the... Now they have all sorts of great flavors for Hamantaschen, but the original Hamantaschen is poppy seed. Poppy seed is the original Hamantaschen. So Muntaschen simply means poppy seed pockets of dough. And there was still a minhag to eat it on Purim. It's interesting. In other words, even before it was called Haman, and that's because on Purim there actually is an inyan to eat things that are encased in other things. Kreplach, for example. Kreplach are...
It's like a dumpling.
Dumpling
in dough.
Kreplach. And they say that that's because of the idea of hiddenness. Purim is about hiddenness, that there's something inside that you don't see. So Hamantaschen were supposed to be hidden as well.
That's why we close the bags on right. From Mishmar Chmanis. You're not supposed to, you're not supposed to spend it in a clear bag so people can,
Oh, that's interesting. I actually didn't hear that. That would be an interesting idea of hiddenness as well. In fact, in Yiddish, there's even an expression. What do they say? There are three times a year that the minhag Yisrael is to eat kreplach. Erev Yom Kippur and Hoshana Rabbah, kind of days of judgment where you hope that there's mercy inside of the judgment, and Purim. Now, those are also 3 days where you beat things. Yom Kippur, or at least, Yom Kippur, you beat your breast. Oh, and you also do the chickens. You throw a circle around the chickens. Hoshana Rabbi, you beat the willows, and on Purim you beat Haman. So in Yiddish, it's actually an expression. People know that if a kid is misbehaving, you know, you say you want to eat some kreplach, because what it does is it associates kreplach with the 3 days, which in turn goes with, you know, hitting him. You know, so it's kind of a double association. Do you want to eat kreplach today? You know, no, it's interesting that in Yiddish, even there's like little expressions like have makaros that connect it to all sorts of things. But as I say, so the original name of was Muntashin, and then somebody figured, well, let's call it Hamuntashin, and after all, by eating it, you're destroying Amalek. Like you look at the Hamuntashin as an embodiment of Amalek. It's almost a Christian symbolism to say that in this thing, you know, as a person, but you're kind of destroying him in that particular way. Yeah.
I mean, I know it's not like we don't do this, but like, we can technically blame, without pointing the finger of blame, King Saul for destroying the
kingdom? Well,
he was sent to destroy it, Agag, which is where Haman comes from.
Listen, this is a very important theme that Chazal emphasized very, very much, because they point out, you know, Shaul HaMelech is from the tribe of Binyamin, and he was given the mission to destroy Amalek, and he let survive the king. The king survived, and although Agag, and although Shmuel the prophet eventually killed the king, but in that short time, the king was able to impregnate a woman somewhere, and that woman became the progenitor, the ancestor of Haman. And Haman was there because Shaul failed to do his job. But what's interesting is that Mordechai and Esther are descended from Shaul. So they were given the divine mission to rectify that which their ancestor did not fulfill. In fact, let me show you this. If you look at the Megillah, but this is not the Megillah, but there's a prayer that is said after the Megillah reading. I hope the Chumash has it. Sometimes it's only in a sitter. Does it have it here? At the very end of the Megillah. Yes, that's right. 1262. Right, so after the nighttime Megillah reading, there is a poem. In fact, Shoshana Shachar, which is a big Purim song, is the end of that poem. But just see this here, seconds. See where it says, this is now alphabet poem. Haman showed his forebears enmity, which is Amalek, and aroused the brotherly hate of Esav on the children. He would not remember Saul's compassion, that through his pity of Agag, Agag was the king of Amalek, the foe was born. And then it goes on. Can they find a line here? No, I believe there's a line here that says, Beferish, that Mordechai and Esther are Mesakein. 1 second, the Vash Sugmi.
Last line.
No, but there's something more, yeah, something more Beferish here. 1 second. Kabi Ashrei, Pigesh Lahashmid. This is the interpretation. Who would arise to atone for error, to gain forgiveness for our ancestors' sins? A blossom bloomed from a lulav branch. That's Esther, because Esther's name is Hadassah, which is a myrtle branch. Hadassah stood up to arouse the sleeping, etc. So this is interpreted to mean, although for some reason I remember a reference to Mordechai. I don't know why I can't see it here. But there is a concept that Esther and Mordechai had to rectify the sin of their ancestor Shaul, who spared Amalek. So in a sense, they kind of fix up what Shaul did. So there's no question. Now, the Gemara says an interesting thing. In the Megillah, Mordechai is described as both a man of Judah, a man from the tribe of Yehuda, and a man from the tribe of Binyamin. And the Gemara says, well, really, he was from Binyamin. He was a descendant of Shaul. But the people of Binyamin blamed Shevet Yehuda for Mordechai, because basically Mordechai was descended from a guy, Shimi ben Gera, who was a Binyamite that David could have killed because he was rebelling against him and didn't. So they said, hey, it's your fault, you Yehuda people's fault, for sparing our ancestor. He shouldn't have been around. So each one is like blaming. So when Mordechai is successful, everybody claims credit. When it looks like things aren't going to be so good, then everybody is saying, oh, it's your problem. That's what the Gra says. What does the Gra say? The Gra says, there's a pasuk in Mishlei that says, a wise son is the joy of the father, and a bad son is the sadness of the mother. So the Gra says, this is how fathers sometimes behave, you know. When the son is doing good, Baruch Hashem, I have such a wonderful son. Son is not doing good, he says to the mother, hey, why don't you take care of him better? That's right. So that's what it says. The joyous, the good son is the joy of the father, the bad son is the problem of the mother. Yeah.
Something that I've just been thinking about the last, 10 minutes or so, and I'm wondering your thought on it. So you said, and I don't know where that verse was, but that Hadassah awoke the people or something along those lines. They were sleeping.
Yeah.
And our the presence of God was hidden. The line you read a bit ago on 1255.
Yeah.
Haman said to King Ahasuerus, there's a certain people.
Right.
In Hebrew it says Yeshno on Han.
That's right.
Now normally when you say there is in Hebrew, maybe I'm just seeing a
connection. No, actually.
So Yesh is usually what you use. Yesh, Yud, Shin.
Yep.
Yeshno, would be spelled the same as sleeping.
Absolutely.
Yeshan.
Is
that the connection?
Yep. Well, let me put it this way. I mean, literally in the English translation, Yeshno is just translated as there is, like Yesh. It's an unusual form. But you're 100% correct. No, you're 100% correct. The Gemara explicitly makes your observation.
Oh, okay.
That Yeshno can be read with slightly different vowelization to mean Yashnu, they are sleeping. And it refers to a complacency to the mitzvahs of Hashem and to Avas Yisrael, and that makes them vulnerable. That's right. So Chazal explicitly say that there is this term of sleeping. Now, once again, I would suggest it's a higher and a lower thing. When Haman is speaking to Ahasuerus, in fact, Haman didn't say it in Hebrew. Haman said it in whatever language he spoke, Persian. Haman meant there is. But on the higher level, it gets translated into that other meaning of Yeshno. Yeshno, they're sleeping. That's right. Okay, have a good day. We'll see you tomorrow.